sight. Caterpillar to a butterfly. Bye bye butterfly.
It's Green and Growing with Ashley Frasca.
Plants, flowers, trees, and stuff.
On 95.5 WSB.
Welcome to your Saturday morning, another edition of Green and Growing right here on 95.5 WSB. Ashley Frasca along with you until 9 o'clock. Want you to be a part of the show. I know you're getting out there in the gardens. I know you're seeing some maybe unusual things, hopefully no diseases because of the recent rains and humidity. But whatever it is, whatever you have questions about, give us a call. Because I noticed a theme in my inbox this last week. I received no less than 3 different pictures of Japanese maple issues from 3 different listeners, and I knew just who to call. My friend Norm Mittleider, he's been on the show for years, certified aesthetic pruner and Japanese maple expert. Norm, thanks for getting up early on a Saturday for us. Good morning.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
I am really thinking of Japanese maples, top of mind. They're leafed out. They're beautiful right now. And they're just, yeah, I mean, I'm saying they're becoming popular in the landscape, but as you well know, Norm, they've been popular, just a beautiful, beautiful focal point of many different landscapes. So want to hit a couple of things with you for listeners. We'll talk about summer care for Japanese maples as we're getting into the hotter months, how to select a healthy tree for someone who's wanting to put the right plant in the right place. You need some room. And then how to tell if one is in decline. Because Norm, you know, I don't hear from people when things are going well. I hear from listeners when something's gone wrong, right?
Absolutely. That's always the case. The issues that get the attention.
Oh, yeah. Well, so let's start with summer care, because I remember venturing out with you a couple of years ago. You took me out on some client visits when you were doing work for clients. And I remember you putting kind of a screening or a netting over some of the Japanese maples to protect them from that hot summer heat. So I don't know what's predicted for this summer, but how do we make sure that they can withstand heat of summer?
The majority of the established trees have acclimated and they will tolerate the heat as long as Mother Nature cooperates and gives them a little water throughout the month. Some of the reasons I do put the covering over the trees is because they have had issues. They might have had winter damage or some other item that puts stress on them. And so to help them along, instead of getting more stress because of that heat of the summer, I will give them a little bit of shade. So it'll lessen the intensity of the heat. But on average, most trees will easily tolerate the summer months.
Well, and you and I talked offline that, you know, some that may be struggling for folks could still be feeling the effects of the pretty detrimental Christmas freeze we had year before last and then the March freeze following that in 2023, remember?
That's absolutely correct. Sometimes it takes a longer period of time for that stress to finally do its thing. And when that happens, it's usually not good.
What would some of the signs be, you know, that someone looking at their Japanese maple now at the beginning of the summer would see that is still lingering winter damage?
Some of the tips of the stems and branches have died back, some more significantly than others. And some of it could be that the leaves don't flush out the way it should have. And some have flushed, but maybe starting to look like they're turning fall colorish, reddish or orangish, and that's usually not a good thing. That stem is shutting down and probably is going to die. Those are the things that I would look for.
And what about if we experience, whether it's a little bit of a drought this summer or an extreme drought, not quite sure which yet, but maybe for a Japanese maple that's new in the landscape, you know, 1 to 3 years old, supplemental watering, how important is that?
That is very important because a tree that's newly planted, it's going to take it a good year to get its roots out there and so that it can draw in all the nutrients it needs. So watering is important, but the biggest mistake is overwatering. You don't want to overwater because the roots need the water, but they don't need to be drowning in it. If they can't breathe, then that's not a good thing.
I love that about our trees and shrubs, how well they adapt. Now, maybe we're not actively overwatering them, but one way that a Japanese maple can stay a little too wet as if it's planted too deeply. And that is one of the issues that I saw with the listener's photograph. He shared with me a little dwarf Japanese maple, probably not that old, but it was like a telephone pole coming out of the soil. You couldn't see a root flare at the base of the trunk at all. That moisture that's going to pond up against the base of the trunk, and like you mentioned, the roots can't breathe, that'll hurt it in a hurry.
I've seen a lot of that. Whenever you plant a Japanese maple, I highly recommend that be planted at least 2 or 3 inches above the existing grade. That way, you're ensuring you're not planting it too low. The other thing is sometimes when they B&B them, or sometimes they're in a pot, they put too much mulch in it. And so you assume that the soil level that you're getting from the nursery is the soil level that it should be planted at, but that's not necessarily true. You need to work away the mulch or soil that's there until you get down to where the trunk and the root flare. Because if you don't see that flare, that's not good.
Right. Talking with Norm Mittleider, the show's beloved Japanese maple expert, and want to help people who want to pick out and select a Japanese maple for their landscape if they're going to shop. First, Norm, if you don't mind, talk about the different forms that we can choose so we have the right plant in the right place, the right shape. And then how do we select a healthy one from the nurseries?
Basically, you have the two habits. One is a vertical upright growing tree, which some can get as tall as 20, 30 feet, but most are usually in the 12 to 18 foot range. The very popular one being sangukaku or coral bark. It has a nice reddish bark to it. That one can get easily 30, 40 feet tall. Another one is the floodgood, which is a burgundy leaf tree, and that one too can get, you know, easily 30, 40 feet tall when it matures. As far as the variety that I like, I just recently planted a fire glow, which is an upright. It should be, you know, 12 to 15 foot tall tree.
Wow.
Beautiful fall color, you know, burgundy in the summer. It's a very nice tree. You also have the mounding type or weeping varieties. Those are usually called lace leaf Japanese maples. Those are the cute little ones you see in the nursery, and you think, oh, that's so cute. And then you plant it, and then 10 years later, you're like, oh, boy,
it's like it becomes a big cousin it.
Yes, it does. Usually what happens, those get planted too close to a driveway, a sidewalk, or the house. Then it's a matter of, oh, I got to whack this and whack that so I can get by.
Yeah, I mean, builders, I'm sorry, but are infamous for that, planting it kind of in an inset of a home, you know, maybe where a window goes back recessed between a front patio and a dining room, and then it's way too big.
With the mounding ones, they're a lot broader because they're kind of growing out as they're going up versus the vertical ones are more just growing up. You definitely want to make sure you take into consideration how big they're going to get, do the homework. See, you know, what the habit is, if they're going to be a small dwarf or if they're going to, because some of those that are only a little pipsqueak in the nursery can actually in time turn out to be easily 10, 12 feet tall and 20 foot wide.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure folks will do their homework, but what are some of the nurseries that you have found really good quality Japanese maples at?
Pike Nursery does have a good selection. You know, you can actually, if you know what you're looking for, get some good ones at Home Depot and Lowe's. I've purchased some trees there. And then, you know, Scottsdale Farm has got some nice trees as well.
I was just there 2 weeks ago in the Milton area. They really do. They've got a lot of acreage.
Yes, they do. Got a lot of nice things up there.
Mm-hmm.
If you like conifers, too.
And Norm, really quickly, we have a couple minutes left to talk about how to tell if your Japanese maple established in the landscape is in decline. And a good example of that, I had somebody share a picture with me of the Japanese maple leaves up close, and they're like a pretty burgundy maroon color, and they're getting these spots on them that are beige, almost tan colored. So that could be an issue. What are some of the other things that we would see that a tree is maybe hurting or in decline?
I think we may have discussed once before the presence of an abundance of lichen. That's usually not a good thing. You might get a little bit, which is okay. But if you have a lot of it, then something is definitely wrong with the environment the tree is in. And obviously the picture is a fungal issue with the leaves, which usually tends to come out this time of year because of the humidity and the dampness.
Right.
And that can be treated with a copper-based fungicide. Just monitor it. And if it continues to get worse, then I would recommend contacting an arborist. But usually one or two applications per the directions usually takes care of it. And obviously the spots that are existing won't go away. But the important thing is that there's not an increase. So as long as you don't get more spots, then your treatment will have succeeded. I've never seen it to where that will go to the extent that it'll cause so much stress that the tree dies. It's just not a pleasant thing to see. You know, winter damage, overabundance of water damage, those are stressful things that can potentially put a tree in decline. And unfortunately, the wrong type of too aggressive pruning, especially on a very mature tree, is not good. There's one up in Connecticut that I was very fond of that I don't think exists anymore The homeowners had somebody go after it too aggressively because it was easily a 60, 70-year-old tree, so it was very mature. You never, ever want to take anything significantly from an older tree. You can do things like the diameter of your finger, but never anything the diameter of your arm, wrist. That's just too much.
Now, I'm glad you brought up pruning really quickly. Do we need to prune anything over the summer, keep it to light pruning, or don't do any at all?
If you're trying to keep a tree within its designated space, you know, some light trimming early in the spring would be important, and maybe later on in the summer, because usually if you trim things in the spring, later on in the summer, they're going to have a second flush. But that second flush typically isn't going to be that strong, unless, of course, it gets a lot of water. You know, water encourages any plant to grow. As long as you're watering moderately, you should just have minimal growth in the late summer, which you may or may not want to address.
Well, Norm, I appreciate the tips that you've given listeners who are anxious to pick out Japanese maples and have them for their very own landscape. I always appreciate you coming on the show, friend.
I always enjoy it.
Have a good Saturday. We'll be back with the top three things to do in the landscape this weekend. It's WSB. The weather update brought to you by Finley Roofing.
Green and growing. Ashley Frasca's top three things to do this weekend.
So many annoyances in the landscape right now. I don't know where to start, but I'm going to cover a lot of them right now. Number one, you can lure slugs and snails underneath a hollowed out half melon like a cantaloupe near your hostas. You check it every day around lunchtime, scrape them into a bucket of soapy water or a shallow pan of beer. Hey, they drown happy. Treat rose sawfly on your roses if the leaves look window paned. And also getting pictures sent to me of lace bug damage on azalea leaves where they look like they've just sucked the chlorophyll, the green, right out of the leaves. So what you can do is spray the shrub with a garden insecticide. Be very conscientious, though. Even though there's no flowers, still pollinators and things flying around during the day. Best to spray and treat in the evening. Number two, another nuisance, maybe little holes in the yard about 2 inches wide. Could be chipmunks. Could be squirrels digging up those acorns that they overwintered. And in garden containers, use red pepper flakes, pine cones, even sweet gum balls on the soil to keep the squirrels from digging in those pots. And number three, the burying bushes that are burying, like blueberries. You just want to have netting on hand to protect your crops from hungry birds. And also, I had Debbie message me on Facebook, bought the sachet bags. You got to get up on a ladder if you want to protect your fruit trees. But you put one of those bags around each of the pieces of fruit that are coming on those trees, and that'll keep the bugs and the critters away. Coming up here at 7:30, an interview that I'm really excited about. Now, today I am away, but I taped this interview just days ago with a couple of ladies in Canada, part of the Canadian Sphagnum Peat Moss Association. And why that's relevant to you as a gardener, you're going to find out. And it's pretty cool. Coming up next on Green and Growing. Stay tuned.
Oh, yeah, the grass is green.
I'm going to live where the green grass grows. The grass is always greener on the other side. Caterpillar to a butterfly.
It's Green and Growing with Ashley Frasca.
Plants, flowers, trees, and stuff.
On 95.5 WSB.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Ashley Frasca with Green and Growing on your radio until 9 o'clock this morning. So glad you're joining me on an early Saturday morning in June. It's going to be a busy month and a hot summer here in Atlanta. Something I came across on the internet not too long ago, and I go down the rabbit hole. I have no idea why I was researching peat moss, but I was. And I'm so glad that I found the website for the Canadian Sphagnum Peat Moss Association. And you think, wow, Ashley, you're pretty deep into gardening. But I was able to reach out to our friends to the north. I wanted to do this interview because you don't understand the ramifications and the importance of peat moss. Maybe as a gardener, you do. Of course, it's in all the potting mix that you buy, but there's so much more to it. So from Canada, I'm so glad to have my guests this morning, Asha Hingorani, and she is the president of the Canadian Sphagnum Peat Moss Association, and Marie-Claire LeBlanc, Peatlands Affairs and Communications Manager. Ladies, welcome to Atlanta.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Thank you very much for hosting us.
Yeah, so much fun. So from now on, the Canadian Sphagnum Peat Moss Association, we're just going to call it short, which I'll do, the CSPMA, if we can. Asha, I'm going to start with you. We've had a couple of conversations leading up to this interview. And as president of that association, how did you get into that job? What is your background?
Great question, and it's something that I get asked a lot. I have a good background in communications and government relations, and because the industry is fairly unknown and there's a lot of misconceptions out there, I guess the board of directors decided they needed someone with some knowledge on how to tap into government relations and have better communication skills. So that's kind of how I landed in the job. Prior to this, I was working with the Canadian wine industry, so not quite far away from transition from Pinot to Peat, but I'm loving it.
And I know we could delve really deep, and we're skimming the surface today. Marie Claire, to you next. What is your background? I read on the website a little bit about geography, but I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, well, I came exactly the opposite door, I think, than Asha. I'm a trained geographer and I'm a land manager. I have also been working for the Peatlands Ecology Research Group based in University Laval, Quebec, Canada, for 15 years before joining the industry. So I really came from the science background. I was doing and coordinating research about peatland restoration in Canada in collaboration with CSPMA. And I transitioned a couple years ago to become the Peatlands Affairs and Communications Manager. So it's really out of a passion for that question, for peatlands and peat restoration and responsible management, that I came to the industry.
And peat is formed of mosses and herbaceous plants that are in the ground, shrubs, small trees. We use it, you know, as a growing medium. It's oftentimes, if not most times, mixed in with potting mixes. But either one of you, what else can peat be used for?
About 30% of the peat that is extracted in Canada is used by everyone in that does the home gardening. So what you buy at the hardware stores, this is approximately 30% of what is produced in Canada in terms of peat. The other 70% that is produced is used for industrial purposes. So when we produce food, most of the vegetables, fruits, berries, mushrooms, herbs are based on peat. At one point in their life stage, they use peat for their production. We also produce a lot of ornamentals. All those plants that you garden with, the trees, reforestation plant seedlings, the cannabis industry is a new industry as well that uses peat. A part of it is for food security, for food safety, and the other part is used for well-being.
Absolutely. You know, during the COVID pandemic, both governments on the U.S. and Canadian side saw the industry as an essential service because of the impact we have on food security and well-being. And of course, without the goods and services that PEAT provides, we'd be in a crisis. So I think it's important to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I don't think folks really wrap their brains around such a small little item, you know, for a gardener, but really with the big ramifications. And y'all's website is tremendously educational. PeatMoss.com is the website to see some videos, read some fascinating things about this. And I learned from the website that it develops at only like really 1 millimeter a year. Speak to the biodiversity, though, that is in the peatlands and all of that that eventually works together to create peat.
Peatlands are really unique ecosystems. If you've never been in one, imagine low bushes, but really it's the surface of the soil that is so unique. It's wet, it's hard to walk in. You can either sink a little bit, or in some areas you'll have some really drier shrubs. So the main species that is the most important one in peatlands is the sphagnum. These are mosses that grow, and that what they do is they don't decompose. They just accumulate because the soil of the peatland is so acidic and water saturated that they do not decompose as opposed to what happens in forests, I would say. So you have also a lot of other plant species that are growing in peatlands that you wouldn't really see anywhere else. All type of shrubs with beautiful flowers blooming right now in the spring. And there's really a unique biodiversity. You'll also find a lot of birds and frogs and animals that use those ecosystems as habitat. But really, I think personally that it's the plant species that make that ecosystem so unique and so special. And really, when you visit one or when you see some pictures, you really think, well, that's something else. That's something I've never seen.
Oh, I can't wait. Y'all are going to provide great pictures for the listeners to really see this beautiful land. They can go on my Facebook page, search Green and Growing WSB on Facebook, and there you can see the pictures. It is a horticulturalist's dream, I bet for sure. We have very hot, humid summers down here in the Southeast, and we have a mountain range. We're very close to the Atlantic Ocean as well. What makes Canada good for peatlands?
It's certainly the cold climate that makes peatlands thrive where they are. To have a peatland, you really have to find the right conditions. And that's why also those ecosystems are so fragile. You have to have this right amount of water that comes from underneath the ground and from the precipitations. And you also have to have the right temperature and the right acidity and also the right type of plant species that are growing there. So it's really the fact that you have all those conditions in one spot that will make peatlands thrive where they are.
Just to add to that comment, in Canada, I don't know how familiar your listeners are with Canadian geography, but we do extract peat in a number of provinces in Canada. So we are considered pan-Canadian: New Brunswick, Quebec, Ontario, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. We don't harvest at the moment in BC, but we are extracting peat from across Canada.
So this is a really unique conversation, guys, very eye-opening. I'm with the Canadian Sphagnum Peat Moss Association. I've got Asha Hingarani with me and Marie-Claire LeBlanc with me as well, and we're talking about peat. It's a common ingredient in potting mixes. It helps plants retain moisture. It improves drainage, as you all know if you've gardened with it, reduces pH levels in alkaline soils, which we don't have that problem. We have very acidic soil here in Georgia. Asha, I could let you talk a little bit about restoration efforts, and really sustainable development is so important to what you all do. And you would think, you know, once the land is cleared and the peat is harvested, gosh, we have to kind of start the process all over again. Why does it take so long for peat to form? And, you know, what is y'all's campaign in letting everyone know how conscious you are of being sustainable?
You're absolutely right, Ashley. I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there about peat. If you were to Google peat right now or peat moss, a lot of information from Europe would come up. There's little about the North American context, and being in Atlanta, I know that your listeners would appreciate more of a North American context. And 90% of our peat does go to the U.S. for many of the reasons Marie-Claire highlighted earlier. But part of our efforts as an association and as an industry is to ensure that a lot of that misinformation is busted. I mean, I was just reading, you know, Greenhouse Growers this morning, and they were saying that in Canada, there's legislation that's pending to prohibit or restrict the use of peat. Well, this is simply untrue. If you were to actually dive down into the facts and the research that the Canadian industry has been engaged in for the last 30 years, you'd realize that, you know, we have come up with techniques to properly restore our peatlands and bring back the ecological functions. What may be a surprise to some is the fact that it could take up to 7 years to actually get a lease on a piece of land to extract peat. Wow. And that includes, you know, we have to make sure we consult with our First Nations and Indigenous communities. We have the species at risk assessment, engagement with various communities. We have to make sure we have a restoration plan in place and approved by the government before we even start extraction. So there's a lot of processes that have to happen before we even begin to extract peat. I mentioned the figure 30 years. Well, the peat industry has been engaged with our academic community, both at the provincial and federal level, as well as universities across Canada, to understand the impacts we have on the peatlands and how we can better mitigate those impacts. And through the last 30 years, the industry has put over $20 million into research to understand greenhouse gas impacts, how to restore our peatlands. And we are finally seeing the results of those that research, which is now Canada has become a world leader, I'd say, in peatland restoration, and other natural resource industries are looking to us to say, hey, how were they able to do that, such as the oil and gas industry, et cetera.
Asha, thank you so much for that. And we're going to take a break. When we come back, Marie-Claire is going to talk more about the responsibility for peatland management and then what we can be doing just as home gardeners, any difference that we can make. You're listening to 95.5 WSB. The weather update brought to you by Finley Roofing. So I am speaking to members of the Canadian Sphagnum Peat Moss Association, and I think this is a really fun conversation. You guys are learning a lot from listening to Asha and Marie-Claire. And Marie-Claire, we'll go back to you with your background in geography and peatlands affairs. Responsible peatland management. How is it done? What do you think?
I think this is where Canadian peat really is a product that people have to know more about. So we hear a lot about peatlands and about peat, but I think what one really has to understand is how much of a leadership the Canadian peat moss industry has shown for decades now. And one of the main aspects of that responsible management approach that is part of our DNA, that is really part of what we do, is the peatland restoration. 30 years ago, even before anybody was really talking about environment in the industrial conversations, the peat industry realized that they had to do something about the land that they were over with. They partnered with university researchers and they developed that method for peatland restoration. Of course, when you use peat, you are taking something out of the ground. But what we're doing is we're restoring the ecosystem functions, and that is what is really important. Biodiversity and carbon sequestration, greenhouse gas mitigation. We're able to do that through a method that is really simple. I invite your listeners to go see our videos on our website and YouTube channels. But really, it's something that is easy for our industry to apply and to do really hands-on on their sites. 70% of the post-extracted sites, so the ones we're over with, have been restored through reclamation or that restoration method. And that really makes a difference. in terms of a responsible management, because we are taking care of our land and we're seeing further than extraction.
I love that, Marie Claire. And you mentioned the website, peatmoss.com, and folks can scroll to the news portion of the site and look at their video series, the ones that you're referencing. Super short, educational, though. Asha, let me ask you this in closing. What can we do? Can we make a difference in the sustainability and the restoration efforts just as gardeners, just as good stewards of the earth?
Watch what you're buying. I mean, Canadian peat, most of the time you'll see 83% of our producers are what we call Veriflora certified, which is a responsibly independent, responsibly managed peatland certification. And the logo is like a little kingfisher bird, but also there's text beside it, which is being developed right now on many of the bags to highlight that that peat has been extracted in a responsibly managed way. Further, I would absolutely encourage your listeners to make sure they do their research. I can't stress that enough. There's so much of my day is spent myth-busting, you know, what's happening in Canada. And I think that if you took the time to do some research, understood what the outcomes of the research is in Canada, to Mary Claire's point, in terms of our outcomes of restoration, for instance, and bringing back the biodiversity, the actual efforts the industry has put in to make sure that we are part of the solution to mitigating climate change, I think that your listeners will be surprised and proud to buy peat going forward.
Ladies, this has certainly been a really good conversation. I wish we could go deeper. We will at some point. The listeners learned a lot. I certainly learned a lot. So Asha and Marie Claire from the Canadian Sphagnum Peat Moss Association. I keep saying I'm going to call it by CSPMA. Thank you, ladies, so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
My
have
pleasure,
a great
Ashley.
Season gardening. Yeah, have a great season using peat and make sure your gardens are thriving this summer.